Hi, everybody. In today's video, we're going to take a look at the thought of Julius Evola. Here's a book of his, A Traditionalist Confronts Fascism. I have a few other videos on Evola on my channel. We're looking at his 1950 Orientations 11 points, meant for young people, to get a quick sense of where he's coming from and what message he wants to convey. So the first point he makes is that we live in a time of the end of a cycle. All hymns to progress ring hollow. And the German and Japanese and Italian responses to Anglo-American liberalism, they were a kind of patchwork solution to deal with the problem. And there wasn't a very clear, as he puts it, discrimination between the essential and the accessory in these currents. In effect, you had this ideological struggle of the 20th century, but where has it left us? Now, when Dugin writes about it, he addresses it at the end of the Cold War. When Evola writes about it, he addresses it at the end of the Axis powers, okay, so the start of the confrontation here between Russia and the United States, or the Soviet Union and the United States. But what's the issue? The issue is that it's a world in ruins, and are there still real men in this world of ruins? Can you still find real men? Not political parties, not institutions, not programs, not slogans, but men. And so that's the point he transitions to next, where he says, we're not really focused on coalitions. We're dealing with the real problem of the surrender of character and every true dignity, as he puts it. A society of consumers and democracy and ideological wasting away. The supremacy of the lowest interests and living day by day. All of these characterize post-war man. So the real problem, he puts it, is of an internal character. Getting up on your feet, standing up inside, giving oneself a form, and creating in oneself an order and uprightness. It's crucial, if you're trying to understand Evola, that that's the key area of interest for him. The inner man, the order of the soul, the principle or idea that you're committed to, then, as we're going to see, the loyalty and brotherhood and spirit, legionary spirit, as he says in point three, that unites this type of person to other kindred souls. And all solutions on a lower plane are ultimately inadequate. So number one, the world is in ruins. Are there still men? Number two, the task of building men is really the key question. We should therefore take a stand against that false political realism that thinks only in terms of programs, partisan political issues, and social and economic recipes. He says all this belongs to the contingent, not the essential. The essential question is slowly to construct a new man to be animated by means of a determined spirit and an adequate vision of life, and fortified by means of an iron adherence to given principles. So point number three, the legionary spirit, the attitude of one who knows how to choose the hardest life, to fight even when he knows that the battle is substantially lost, and to put loyalty above all things, because such a man, in him, the traditional idea is affirmed. Okay, the traditional idea here means the idea of tradition, not of modernity, not of taking it easy, not of comfortable self-preservation, not the bourgeois spirit, not the left social justice spirit, but commitment to something higher and to the people that are united in that commitment. A sense of honor and shame, not half-hearted measures drawn from half-hearted morals, okay, but rather this sense of honor and shame that creates a substantial difference, an existential difference between beings, almost as though between one race and another race. So this is not biological racism. This is a racism of the spirit, the higher type of man, the lower type of man. So that's the next crucial point. The style that has to achieve prominence in all this is that of one who holds his positions out of loyalty to himself and to an idea, an intense absorption in a rejection of every compromise, in a total commitment that must manifest itself not only in the political struggle, but also in every expression of existence. The fourth point is basically that this new movement of men is to repeat a kind of right-wing anti-liberalism. So neither the bourgeois consumption of the ordinary middle-class capitalist type, nor the social justice of the left, but rather something else. He says it has contempt for the bourgeois myth of security and the petty life that is standardized, conformist, domesticated, and moralized. So it has a contempt both for the bourgeoisie and for the proletarian. And next, still within this point, something essential will have been achieved when we revive the love for a style of active impersonality, through which what counts is the work and not the individual. Now, there's a line in Christian thought that I like in the New Testament, which is this: I'm crucified with Christ, nevertheless I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. Beautiful, powerful image. And what does it mean? It means the self has been set aside so that a higher principle or a higher task, in this case, Christ, can work through you. That's a kind of active impersonality. It's active, but it's not yourself, because I am crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ liveth in me. So you can take that structurally and say for Evola, it's similar here. You're there, you're actively participating, but you've set yourself aside in the service of a higher principle that works in you and through you. As he puts, what counts is the work and not the individual. Through this, we become capable of not seeing ourselves as something important, since what is important is the function, the responsibility, the task accepted, and the end pursued. Okay, in some sense, the work you're doing, the great work, your destiny, your fate, and the active principle that's working through you. Where this spirit is achieved, spirit of active impersonality, many problems will be simplified, including problems of economic and social order, which would otherwise remain insoluble if confronted from outside. So once again, you could say two simple approaches to the solution of political problems, one that deals with parties, organizations, institutions, arrangements, policies, you know, somehow dealing with the externalities, and another one that's focused on character building, soul, personality, race in the sense of spiritual race, whether or not you're building up the true man. Evola very clearly here puts his emphasis on the first part, and then all organization follows from that starting point. Point five, I'd like to read. It is important not only for doctrinal orientation, Evola writes, but also in regard to the world of action, that the men of the new group, which is what the first four points have been talking about so far, precisely recognize the chain of causes and effects and the essential continuity of the current that has given life to the various political forms that are jousting today in the chaos of the parties. So in other words, this new group of men must understand the cause and effect on the ideological plane, what's going on. They have to have an understanding of the ideological dimension of the present. Liberalism, then democracy, then socialism, then radicalism, and finally communism and Bolshevism only appeared historically as steps taken by the same evil, as stages in which each one prepares the next in the complex unity of a process of decline. So Evola would like the people he's addressing to see that it's one spirit that animates liberalism, democracy, socialism, radicalism, communism, and Bolshevism, one spirit in its decline. The beginning of this process is the point at which Western man shattered the fetters of tradition. So the beginning is the onset of the anti-traditional modern mentality, the point at which Western man rejected every superior symbol of authority and sovereignty, claimed a vain and illusory liberty for himself as an individual, and became an atom instead of a conscious part in the organic and hierarchical unity of a whole. So Evola here very clearly taking the side of the anti-modern thinkers who see modernity as a shattering, a massification, an atomization, a destruction of community, and to repeat here, a rejection of every superior symbol of authority and sovereignty. In the end, the atom was bound to find that the mass of the other atoms, the other individuals, had turned against him, and he was dragged into the plight of the kingdom of quantity. Now, you may know here René Guénon, another traditionalist, who has a book called The Reign of Quantity. So man was dragged into the kingdom of quantity, of pure number, of masses that are given over completely to materialism and who have no other god than the sovereign economy. So somehow massification, atomization, and quantification equals sovereignty of the economy. In this process, there's no stopping halfway down the road. Without the French Revolution and liberalism, there would not have been constitutionalism and democracy. Without democracy, there would not have been socialism and demagogic nationalism. Without the preparation of socialism, there would not have been radicalism and finally communism. So I won't continue reading all of this, maybe one or two more lines. The great illusion of our days is that democracy and liberalism are the antithesis of communism and have the power to stem the tide of the forces of the low, of the progressive movement and the jargon of the labor movements. In other words, you're saying, don't be a communist, be a liberal. Don't go down the road of the labor unions and the progressive movement. Rather, emphasize individual and political liberty. But for Evola, it's all of a piece. It all tends in one direction. It's all destructive of tradition, and it produces those ruins among which we are looking for real men. And the real men that we find or that we help to create must understand this. Therefore, he calls for us to rid ourselves of ideological distortion, which unfortunately is widespread even in some of our young people. Then he addresses the point of being a reactionary. He says, yeah, don't worry about being called a reactionary. He says the following, as to the charge of reactionary, ask them the following question. While you are acting, destroying, and profaning, do you then want us not to react, but to stand by passively watching or maybe even shouting, good work, keep it up? We are not reactionaries only because the word is not strong enough, and especially because we start from what is positive and we represent what is positive, values that are real and original. So in other words, what's he saying? On one hand, it's correct for us to react because we're reacting against degeneracy, decrepitude, decay, and destruction. And on the other hand, we're doing more than reacting because we're acting in accordance with a higher principle. That is point five, where he also says that both Americanism and communism are the enemy. Point six, no economic supremacy. You can't allow economic analysis to dominate your thought. That sort of follows from point five. So just because you're anti-proletarian doesn't mean you're pro-capitalist. Just because you are anti-capitalist doesn't mean you're pro-proletarian. Beyond this sphere, beyond this economic sphere, we need to separate an order of superior values, which are political, spiritual, and heroic. So this is a kind of anti-economism. You have to rise above the plane of economic dispute rather than becoming one of the parties in that economic dispute. It is only in terms of this order, this higher order, that it's proper to define the things for which it is worth living and dying, which establish a true hierarchy, he's a hierarchical thinker, which differentiate new ranks of dignity. You must have rank, you must have dignity, nobility. And at the top, place on the throne a superior function of command and imperium. So you see here, we have a structure of nobility, dignity, hierarchy, superiority, authority, command, versus the market and its extremes, whether the labor unions on one hand or the capitalists on the other. So moreover, he says that we should have a deproletarianization. Deproletarianization means, he says, disinfecting those parts of the people which are still healthy of the socialist virus. Only then can one or another reform be studied and implemented without danger according to true justice. So the proletarian interpretation of social justice is dangerous, misleading, and you've heard of denazification. Well, here Evola is calling for deproletarianization. Okay, another author who has an analysis of the proletarian, not Evola, but also from a right-wing anti-liberal perspective, is Arthur Moeller Vandenbroek in his work called The Third Reich. So that is point six. We're replacing the economic idea with an integral hierarchical idea. Point seven distinguishes between totalitarian and organic conceptions. And Evola is against totalitarianism. If you watch my video, Julius Evola Fascism Viewed from the Right, you'll get some more details of that, how he criticized fascism from the perspective of a more genuinely traditionalist right. So this is part of it. You don't want to be totalitarian. You want to be have an organic conception of the state and its people. But crucially, he says, these new structures need a center, a highest point of reference. A new symbol of sovereignty and authority is necessary. The commitment in this regard must be precise. It's important to say clearly that we are dealing here with commitment to an idea. Commitment to an idea, okay? And this is going to be a point that he makes. We're not talking about in point eight. We'll just move to point eight. He says, we're not talking about a nationalism of blood and soil. We are talking about a nationalism of the idea. So the political level per se is one of superior unities when compared to unities defined in naturalistic terms, like those to which the general notions of nation, fatherland, and people correspond. On this superior level, the one that Evola wants us to think about, What unites and what divides is the idea, an idea born by a definite elite intending to achieve concrete form in the state. As he puts it in his summary to point eight, idea, order, elite, state, and men of the order, we should maintain the battle lines in these terms for as long as possible. So he started with the fifth at the beginning of this set of reflections, right? The question was, where are the men? Can we still find the men? But now he's gradually leading us up to the idea as being the most important thing. So you have the men, they should be organized in a state, they should be organized under an elite. An elite should be ordered in a certain way, and at the top of that order should be the authority and sovereignty of the idea. Hierarchical, vertical, ideocracy, okay, rule of the idea. Point nine, something must be said in regard to the problem of culture. And here what he says is that we have three important movements we have to reject: Darwinism, psychoanalysis, and existentialism. Against Darwinism, we must reclaim the fundamental dignity of the human person by recognizing its true place, which is not that of an individual, more or less evolved animal species among so many others. Rather, it is one which can be elevated virtually beyond the biological level. Okay, so there's a spiritual element in Evola's teaching, which is not compatible with Darwinism. Darwinism removes that spiritual level, and Evola would like to transcend Darwinism by reintroducing the spiritual level. The biologistic Darwinian myth, in one variant or another, has the precise value of a dogma defended by the anathemas of science in the materialism of both Marxist and American civilization. Modern man has gotten used to this degraded conception, tranquilly recognizing himself in it and finding it natural. So you have to oppose Darwinism. Next, you have to oppose psychoanalysis, and in particular, the ideal of an ego which does not abdicate and which intends to remain conscious, autonomous, and sovereign in the face of the nocturnal and subterranean parts of his soul and the demonic character of sexuality. In other words, according to psychoanalysis, an ego can feel repressed and torn apart, and you have the whole subterranean psychosexual energies playing on this authoritarian ego who tries to keep everything suppressed and in control. But in Evola's view, no, the ego does not feel repressed or psychotically torn apart. The ego achieves an equilibrium of all faculties ordered in accordance with the higher significance of living and acting. So it's kind of like it's a democratic dogma that you have to put your emphasis on the psychological proletariat, the psychological demos, the psychological lower classes, the psychological marginalized, the subconscious irrational, and all of that. It's kind of like the psychology here, the psychoanalysis, is following an a priori strong democratic commitment. But in Evola's model, there's a different model of the psyche. There's a different model of the soul. It's not all about subversion and the revolutionary substitution of the higher by the lower, as he puts it, and contempt for every principle of authority. No, you can actually just have a well-ordered soul ruled by the best parts of the soul. In this sense, a very classical teaching, okay? Because that's true of Plato and Aristotle as well, where the psychoanalytic is not predominant. Rather, desire has its place, spiritedness has its place, and prudence and wisdom have their place, and they can be well-ordered without it being necessarily the case that there's an unwinnable war, unwinnable by the higher part of the soul, and that the revolutionary, subterranean, underground, psychosexual madmen are always going to tear authority and sovereignty from limb to limb. There's that threat. Everybody knows that. But for Evola, it's also possible to just be a healthy soul. And apparently for psychoanalysis, that's less the case in his presentation. So no Darwinism, no psychoanalysis. And finally, as for existentialism, he says, even if we distinguish what is properly a philosophy, a confused philosophy that up until yesterday remained relevant only to a narrow circle of specialists, it's necessary to recognize in it, so even if you just think it's this little academic movement, it's necessary, which existentialism spilled out by this time into something broader than just a little academic movement, as he knows, it's necessary to recognize in it the spiritual state of a crisis that has become systematized, being the truth of a shattered and contradictory human type which experiences a liberty by which it does not feel elevated as anguish, tragic fate, and absurdity. So just roughly, don't think about Heidegger's Being and Time if you've never read it, but what's your gist, your sense of existentialist thought? Your freedom is related to nausea, to an abyss, to anxiety, to tragedy, to absurdity, to meaninglessness to some extent. And as Evola characterizes it, he says, such people feel rather condemned without escape and responsibility to this end in the midst of a world stripped of value and meaning. So existentialism is a teaching about the abyss and meaninglessness. But all this should be rejected, especially when the best of Nietzsche had already indicated a way to rediscover a sense of existence and to give oneself a law and value untouchable even in the face of a radical nihilism. Under the banner of a positive existentialism, according to Nietzsche's own expression, that of a noble nature. So Darwinism, which reduces us to biologistic evolutionary interpretation and deprives us of the higher spiritual type. Psychoanalysis, which does the same thing, it deprives us of the possibilities of a healthy spirituality by subsuming everything under the neuroses and psychoses of the lower basement of the soul. And existentialism, which leaves us with a sense of meaninglessness and tragedy, all of those things should be rejected. And the rejection should not just be intellectual, it should be lived and realized in the inner life and its conduct. Getting back on our feet is not possible as long as we remain in any way under the influence of similar forms of false and twisted ways of thinking. So these wrong teachings can set you on the wrong path, overcome them, and you have the possibility of living a noble life like a real man among the ruins and building up a new world. In point 10, Evola ultimately says that this new man who's anti-bourgeois and anti-proletarian, as we saw, he's still going to have an intolerance for every form of rhetoric and false idealism, for all those big words that are written with capital letters, okay, capital H honor, capital T truth, capital L love, for everything that is only gesture, phrase, effect, and scenery. So just because you're a right-wing anti-liberal, just because you're anti-bourgeois and anti-proletariat, just because you have this commitment to a brotherhood of loyal soldiers in subservience to a higher idea or ideal, it doesn't mean that you want to fall back into just rhetoric, just a false idealism, just big words, just big talk. The essential, on the other hand, as he puts it, is a new realism in measuring oneself exactly by the problems that will face us and in acting so that what counts is not appearance, but being, not gossiping, but accomplishing in silent and exact manner, in harmony with related forces and adhering to the command that comes from above. So you don't want your right-wing anti-liberal sophistry. You don't want your right-wing anti-liberal performance, LARPing. You want the real deal, being, acting, accomplishing, and not just yapping and play-acting. So that for him is very important. And he said that under the fascist regime, the human substance was not equal to the task, and it was possible to make rhetoric even from the steadfast rejection of rhetoric. So there were not men equal to the task in the fascist regime for Evola. And it's very important that in a genuine traditionalist right, that problem is overcome. No mere talkers, but you want to be. You don't just want to seem. You want to do. You don't just want to say. Point 11, the last point of his 11 points, has to do with religion. He says, let us briefly consider relations with the dominant religion. For us, the secular state in whatever form belongs to the past. So he's not a proponent of the secular state. He's not a proponent of the ethical state, which is primarily focused on a secular protection of human rights and all of that sort of thing. No, secularism out the door. So what does that mean? What's the opposite? He says, well, if we oppose similar ideologies and the secular state, in other words, on one hand, everything that denies the political relevance of religion at the official level of state organization. For us, a clerical and clericalizing state is equally unacceptable. So not to be secular doesn't mean you want rule by clergy. So how do you understand then the relationship between religiosity and the state in Evola's model? Here's what he says. A religious factor is necessary as a background for a truly heroic conception of life, such as must be essential for our group. So you need a religious factor that's necessary. Necessary to what? To a truly heroic conception of life. It is necessary. Why? Because it's necessary to feel the evidence in ourselves that beyond this earthly life, there's a higher life. Because only someone who feels this way possesses a force that cannot be broken or overwhelmed. Only this kind of person will be capable of an absolute leap. So on the basis of evolutionary dogma, no absolute leap. On the basis of psychoanalysis, apparently, let's say, no absolute leap. Existentialism, even though there's talk of a leap there, it deprives you of this breakthrough, a force that can go to something higher with the will that can't be shattered. Religion is necessary for that. When this feeling is lacking, challenging death and placing no value on his own life is possible only in sporadic moments of exaltation and in an unleashing of irrational forces. Nor is there a discipline that can justify itself with a higher and autonomous significance in such individuals. So a religious belief that beyond this earthly life, there's a higher life, it allows you to challenge death and place no value on your own life, which is necessary for a heroic order, if you think about it. In fact, the story of modernity, partially, is a story of depriving men of belief in a higher life so that they no longer are fearless in the face of death, but begin to believe that death is the greatest evil, so that the new scientists, the philosopher scientists, can now sell you the things that guarantee that your life will be long and comfortable and good. Because if death is the greatest evil and life is the greatest good, and philosophy can be made to serve life, meaning not the best life, but the most comfortable life, a life of security and the satisfaction of basic needs, a life of production and consumption, then it helps to deprive people of the belief in a higher order. You see, that's a long story. But here we just go back here. You need the religious belief. It allows you to face death. It allows you to aim higher. Nevertheless, although you must have this among the people, it need not take the obligatory dogmatic formulations of a given religious confession. Meaning, he's not saying the traditionalist order must be Catholic or X or Y. In fact, he says the lifestyle that must be led is not that of Catholic moralism, which aims at little more than a domestication of the human animal based on virtue. Doesn't sound very heroic. Politically, this spirituality can only nourish diffidence before everything that is an integral part of the Christian conception. Certainly says if Catholicism were capable of making a capacity for high asceticism its own, in other words, if you could restore the spirit of the best aspects of the Middle Ages of the Crusades, almost the new order of Templars, in effect, he says, in a case like this, then we would choose Catholicism. But the way things are now, as things stand, given that is the mediocre and essentially bourgeois and parochial level to which practically everything that is confessional religion has descended, and given its surrender to modernism and the growing opening of the church to the left, for our men, he says, the mere reference to spirit can suffice. Okay, so you need to have a religious background. You can't necessarily go all in on Catholic Christianity or on the other religious movements that have opened their doors to modernity and to the left. You need something to invoke, and it's enough for our men to invoke spirit as evidence of a transcendent reality. We must invoke it to inoculate into our force another force, to feel in advance that our struggle is not only a political struggle, and to attract an invisible consecration upon a new world of men and leaders of men. That's his 11th point. Now I will read you his summary, and you can walk away from this video with some overarching sense of Evola's teaching in 1950 concerning the world in ruins and the possibility of a new order of men. These, Evola writes in conclusion, are a few essential guidelines for the battle we have to fight, directed especially to young people, so that they may grasp the torch and the commitment from those who have not fallen, learning from the errors of the past and knowing well how to distinguish and revise everything that was affected by and still affected today by contingent situations. It is essential, he writes, not to sink to the level of our adversaries, not to be reduced to manipulating simplistic slogans, you saw that, and not to insist excessively on the past, which, even if worthy of being remembered, does not have the contemporary and impersonal value of the force idea. In other words, this is true of Arthur Moeller Vandenbroek, the German conservative revolutionary I mentioned earlier. These traditionalist thinkers, when they talk about tradition, they're not just talking about what lies in the past. They're talking about that which is eternal and which therefore exists in its own way in the past, present, and future, a point Alexander Dugin has written nicely about. So you don't want to insist excessively on the past. It's likewise mandatory not to yield to suggestions of a false politicizing realism, which is the weak point of every party. So remember, you have to rise above the plane of the economic. You have to rise above the plane of the merely political. Our forces must also act in the hand-to-hand political struggle, so it's not an abdication of the realm of the political, in order to create room for us to maneuver in the present situation and to limit the assault of the forces of the left. But beyond that, it is important, indeed essential, to form an elite that can define an idea with intellectual rigor and intellectual intransigence in rapt intensity. We must unite around this idea, remember that point, and affirm it, especially in the form of the new man, the man of the resistance, the man who stands upright among the ruins. Okay, that's who Evola is trying to reach. And that's who Evola is trying to summon. If it is granted to go beyond this period of crisis and unsteady and illusory order, the future will look to this man alone. The destiny that the modern world has created for itself is now overwhelming it. Even if it is not fated to be contained, if we stand by these premises, the ones that we just went over in this writing called Orientations 11 Points, our inner state will be maintained. Whatever happens, what can be done will be done, and we shall belong to that fatherland that no enemy will be able to occupy or destroy. Julius Evola, hope you learned something from that. Hope you enjoyed it. Like this video, subscribe to the channel, comment if you wish, and you should always visit millermanschool.com for courses on certain traditionalist thinkers and political philosophers and others, including Carl Schmitt, Vandenbroek, Heidegger, Nietzsche, and others. No courses on Evola. I put all my work on him here on my YouTube channel for free so far. Okay, guys, thanks for watching. See you in the next video.